I am so pleased to see all of you here for this final session of our 45th National Immunization Conference. It's been a terrific conference. You know, every year I think it can't get any better, and it does. And so thanks to everybody who contributed, to the teams that worked together on planning the schedule, the great conference planning team in our Immunization Services Division, the contractor who helps with putting on the conference, all of the folks at the hotel, and the team that's handled our audiovisual needs. It's just been a great conference, and of course it wouldn't have even been a conference without all of you. So thank you for coming, and thank you for sticking around to the last session. You know, for I guess the last 5 years, I've had a chance to try to sum up the big themes of the conference for all of you who stick around till the very end. And so one of the things I try to do is pick up the mood and sort of where we all are as a national program. And there was a few years ago where it all felt very unsettled and threatened, and there had been a tornado the weekend before, and it was a very unsettled kind of conference. And then last year, it was just after the pandemic, and like everybody was really tired. This year, it's a different kind of sense. I know that everybody has been through really challenging times, that the budget issues at the state and local level have affected everybody, whether you're a public health person or not. If you're part of the immunization community, you've seen how hard people have had to work to deal with the resource challenges that everybody's been facing and that are going to be with us for a while going forward. I don't think there's any way around it. But in spite of all that, the sense I'm picking up from all of you is that we all get that we're at a really important place in our national immunization program, that there's a whole series of events based on long-term developments, investments that have been made earlier, work that's already been done, logical progressions of things that have been moving along at a certain rate, as well as, you know, some kind of unanticipated things, some big things like the Affordable Care Act, that have all come together to really create a historic opportunity to move things forward in a big way. And what came to me as I was thinking about how to capture all this in a phrase is what I've selected for my title. So can you guys put the slides up, please? I think we're at a tipping point. And this phrase actually, you know, although it was part of, you know, sort of English language before, really became part of normal conversation back in 2000 when Malcolm Gladwell, who I think is a writer for the New Yorker magazine, published this book. And what he had as his subtitle was How Little Things Can Make a Big Difference. And I think for where we are, that's not actually the point I want to make. It's that if you're at a tipping point, the next step really matters. Because we're at a point where if our next steps are in the right direction, I think we can really move things forward in a very exciting and historic kind of way. And I think we're in a good place to do that. And so much of the information presented at this conference was exactly what we needed to help us do that. So although everybody appreciates the challenges, the sense I'm getting from you all is that we can see the road ahead, we know what we need to do, and we're prepared to do it. And that's really exciting. So one of the areas where I think we're at a tipping point has to do with the convergence of information systems. And we heard a lot about that at this conference. Gary Urquhart told us about where we were with HL standard messaging in our grantee immunization information systems and how much progress we've made. We're continuing to make investments to help help practices that use electronic health records achieve interoperability with immunization information systems and identify those best practices to sustain these improvements. We still, of course, have our challenges with data completeness. Lot numbers have been a problem. It's been hard to capture that information, but there's new technology that as it's introduced into the United States, where it hasn't been yet, can really help us move this forward. And in her opening talk, Anne had a great diagram that sort of talked about how it's all connected and how the information flow can work. Of course, there's our centralized distribution that addressed issues around vaccine flow, but then there's information flow from providers to immunization information systems and health departments, from electronic health records into immunization information systems, VTRACs that will then allow us to consolidate ordering and link with health departments, doctor's offices, barcodes that hopefully will be able to capture some of this information that we've not really been able to capture very well into those electronic health records, providing decision support, improving vaccine accountability, helping our ability to do tracking of vaccine safety and vaccine recalls, and helping us to manage shortages, and helping providers achieve those meaningful use goals. So it's a historic convergence. It's a great opportunity, and the work that you all are doing is helping us take advantage of it. The next big thing is the Affordable Care Act. And I talked about this, I guess it was just yesterday, though it feels like a couple of days ago, about how one of the things that happened in the Affordable Care Act is as new plans are written, there will be coverage for ACIP-recommended vaccines for insured people without deductibles or copays when delivered by an in-network provider. And that is just huge. Now, it's going to take a while before it all happens, and there's still some uncertainties around some of the policy decisions and implementation issues. But that's what's written into the law. And once all the dust settles, where we should end up is a system that is based on continued shared responsibility between public and private sectors. And for insured people, insurance should assure access to ACIP-recommended vaccines for both children and adults. This problem of the underinsured should be finally resolved. We'll still have the Vaccine for Children program to provide vaccines for the uninsured children, children who are eligible for Medicaid, and American Indian, Alaska Native children. And then we should have an opportunity to refocus 317 really on the groups that are left. And among those groups that are left are uninsured adults. So for the first time, we may finally be able to make some inroads in that population. This may allow us to address, finally, some of the barriers for adult vaccination. This is a slide from Stephanie Bilek's talk about zoster vaccine, which shows the barriers for adult vaccination that we're all familiar with. And maybe, finally, we can make some inroads on this. The next big idea that I heard in the conference was the importance of getting the strategy right. And, you know, we don't always get it right the first time. Amanda Cohn just told us about how we'd made some assumptions about the duration of protection for the meningococcal conjugate vaccine, and so we made the recommendation when the vaccine was first licensed to use it at 11 to 12 years of age, and we're finding it doesn't provide protection through the period of highest risk, so we've changed our strategy. That's why it's so important for us to have the data that allows us to evaluate our strategies and make those course corrections, because if you don't have the information, you can't figure out, don't even know if you've got the right strategy or not, much less what to do about it. And we heard lots of great examples of the importance of this at the conference. This is from Kathy Gallagher's presentation on mumps. where she talked about delivery of a third dose of MMR vaccine for outbreak control. This was in Orange County, New York, and the group that received the third dose were the adolescent kids, which is the group where the outbreak was really focused on. And you can see that yellow line, how dramatically, although it was already going down before the intervention started, how it was reduced much more quickly than disease in other age groups. So we may finally have something we can do when these outbreaks occur. Pertussis in adolescents has been an issue for so many of us for so many years. We did finally get a vaccine licensed for use in adolescents, and we started using it, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. And what we see is that it has impacted disease in that age group. That's, I think it's the yellow line there for the 11 to 19-year-olds on the graph. And you can see that disease has gone down in that age group. But we've had increases in some other age groups, and those are continuing to be a challenge, and it's going to take more work to figure out exactly how to address those issues. This slide has been shown a lot of times. It was in Lori Markowitz's talk just now about how we are not managing to get HPV vaccine to our adolescent girls. We're not doing so badly at starting the series, but we're not getting the series completed. And this is a problem that we really need to solve. We need to identify the right strategy so that we can address this, because this is an area where we definitely can do better. Now, speaking of doing better, a few years ago, although global polio eradication had made great progress, the sort of finishing it up just wasn't happening, and it was proving very difficult. There were reintroductions in polio-free countries. There was just very stubborn disease that was not. We weren't making progress, and so there were new tools that were developed, a monovalent oral polio vaccine, which when it was introduced did reduce type 1 polio, but resulted in increases in type 3. And this whole issue of balancing the trivalent vaccine with the monovalent vaccine proved quite difficult. Well, now there's a bivalent vaccine that has type 1 and type 3 in it, and hopefully this new tool, along with other new strategies that the polio eradication program has implemented, will allow us to move polio eradication to the goal line. And Bruce Aylward gave us a wonderful update on this on Tuesday with lots of very exciting data, including how the loss of viral diversity among type 1 polio in Africa. You know, the more diversity you've got, the more foci of transmission there are. And as those foci of transmission are shut down, the virus becomes less and less diverse, and that's shown very dramatically in these data that Bruce showed on Tuesday. But even more dramatic is where we are with polio right now in the world. And these are historic lows, and right now there is an opportunity to achieve major new landmarks in some of the countries that have never eliminated polio, India and Nigeria, and it's really a historic opportunity. It was a very exciting story. You know, for years at this conference, we've been talking about vaccine hesitancy or vaccine acceptance, but, you know, what I was hearing this year was a little different. It was more vaccination as normative behavior. It wasn't so much how to deal with people who were concerned, but sort of how to deal with the general milieu, where actually most people aren't all that concerned, and appropriately address the people who are concerned, but maintain the norms. And it was sort of a different conversation this year. Of course, there are still the issues about how to deal with people who have concerns, because there are people who have concerns, and we all need to help the frontline immunization providers, some of which are you, to address those concerns in an empathetic, respectful way that also can be fit into the busy schedule of the clinic. And we had some great talks on this at the conference. This slide is from Ed Marcuse's presentation, which really talks about a communication style that's based on risk communication principles, which clearly is how we need to be doing this. There also is the toolkit that our wonderful communications team has been developing with a whole variety of new materials that are gradually getting rolled out on the cdc.gov/vaccines/conversations website. And more of those will be coming out for National Infant Immunization Week, and we're very excited about that. There also is a community intervention project that is explicitly aimed at maintaining this normative behavior that our colleagues in Washington State are undertaking. And Ed Mercuse talked about this on Monday, I guess it was. These are new efforts, and it's very exciting. And we're all looking forward to finding out how all this plays out. Now, the last theme I wanted to bring up was another one that really resonated throughout the conference, which has to do with telling our story. There were presentations that were explicitly about storytelling. Bill Smith's wonderful presentation about storytelling as a communication technique. But storytelling, really telling our story, really was a theme throughout the conference this year. This is from Bill Smith's presentation. To be a person is to have a story. And there's a wonderful story here to tell. And, you know, I think all of us can learn how to tell that story better. Many of us are by temperament and by training not so inclined to tell stories in a very warm or human or compelling way. We tend to tell our stories with numbers. And numbers can tell a great story. We saw in Dr. Shuckett's opening presentation and also in Dan Payne's presentation during the meeting, the great story that we have with our success with rotavirus vaccine, which of course had its previous challenges, right? We had a rotavirus vaccine in 1999, but it caused intussusception at a pretty high rate, and that vaccine was dropped. The new vaccines have been very effective. We've got a just very dramatic reduction in rotavirus disease among young children. But all stories, to be good stories, have challenges, and this story has its challenge too. That there has been a finding of a risk of intussusception with the newer vaccines. These are studies that have been done globally. We haven't seen this in the United States, but in other countries, an increased risk of intussusception has been found. But it's much lower than the risk that we're seeing with the previous vaccine. And because we've got such strong data about the benefits of vaccination, as well as these very good quantitative estimates of risk, it's possible to really look at risks and benefits and help support good decision-making about how to use these vaccines. And even if we make the assumptions that we would see the same level of risk that's been seen in some other countries, we still have a risk-benefit comparison that's strongly in favor of vaccination. Now, another kind of number we use in stories are dollars. And in the current climate, being able to tell your story in terms of how much you save, whether it be cases prevented or lives saved or dollars saved, is very, very important. And Dr. Shuckett also showed this slide in her opening presentation. Our group of health economists have been working very hard at CDC to update the original analysis that was published in 2005 for the cost effectiveness of the childhood immunization schedule through varicella. That is now being updated to include the newer vaccines that we use in young children. And what this new analysis shows, that for each birth cohort vaccinated against 13 diseases in accordance with the schedule, we save 42,000 lives, prevent 20 million cases of disease, save $13.6 billion in direct medical costs, almost $70 billion in indirect costs, and for each dollar we invest in vaccinations, $10.20 is saved. It's very important, as all of us are thinking about, you know, where do we invest our federal dollars, where do we invest our public dollars? Where does, as a society, do we focus our attention to be able to tell our story in economic terms? And so this is a great story to be able to tell. But there's other stories, too, that aren't about those kinds of numbers. And this is a slide from Bill Smith's talk that to really be effective, you know, a story has a hero and a villain and a challenge and a victory and a lesson, all on a journey, and it has to connect with you as a human being. And ideally, it inspires awe and shows people how to solve problems. And you know, that's kind of a tall order. But we've got those stories, too, and we heard one of them Tuesday morning. And in case any of you missed it, I'm going to give you the short version. In Africa, there's a group of countries where meningitis occurs every year and where very, very large epidemics occur in some years. And this is called the meningitis belt in sub-Saharan Africa. This is mostly meningitis type A, which is not a type that we see in the United States. Occasionally, there's other types as well, but it's mostly meningitis A. And these are devastating epidemics that are catastrophic. The attack rates can be very high, large numbers of cases, and devastating to families and a serious drain on the fragile economies and governments of these countries. In bad years, attack rates can be as high as 1%. These are very large epidemics. There was a project that was started a few years ago as a partnership between the World Health Organization and PATH, with support from the Gates Foundation, that decided to create a vaccine for Africa. The vaccines we've got are cost too much, and they're not going to do the job for Africa. So there was a consortium that was developed that include lots of different partners, and an FDA-developed technology and a manufacturer in India that has created a vaccine for Africa for 40 cents a dose, a price so low that even these poor countries should be able to, in the long term, introduce this vaccine and sustain it. Vaccine introduction began last September, and the rollout should be completed this year in the other two countries. So it's already, Burkina Faso has already introduced vaccine, and it started in Mali and Niger, but isn't complete yet. There was huge turnout and interest for the population in these countries, because this was a feared disease. This was something everybody wanted for their child, and also young adults, adolescents and young adults were vaccinated as well. And so what's happened in Burkina Faso? There have been only two cases of serogroup meningococcal disease reported this year, and they were both in unvaccinated adolescents. Talk about awe. Bill Foege was talking about disease eradication in this slide that Bruce Aylward included in his presentation, and we heard these same messages from Dr. Foege in the Hilleman lecture Monday night. Our programs attack inequities in ways that other programs don't so effectively, and we contribute to social justice. So I started off by saying that if you're at the tipping point, the next step matters. And I think we are in a good place to take that next step. You would think, with everything that's gone on, we might not be. You know, there was an influenza pandemic, and there's been, you know, a really tough budget, and there's been lots of stuff of all kinds of different sorts that you guys have had to deal with. But in spite of it all, I think we're in a really strong place from which to move forward. But the next things we do should be the things that move us toward the future. And I'm confident that if we take those next steps, we indeed can build healthier families, healthier communities, and a healthier world. Thank you for being here, and I'll see you next time in 2 years at the 46th National Immunization Conference in Atlanta. Thank you very much.